Hi, it's Mike. It's Saturday. It's the Saturday show. One from the vault, one from the week. And from the week, I don't know if you heard, but the other day, RFK skinned a bear. Wanted to skin a bear. Stored the bear in a van. Anyway, it lent itself. And it wasn't the other day. It was 10 years ago. But he admitted it the other day in a format that has become just the de facto way to confess your sins. A online video with Roseanne Barr reacting. In shock, actually. So the other day, RFK revealed that, and in a quick turnaround through story and song, we presented it to you. That's our first segment. You must hear, you must know what RFK did to the bear. This also, of course, inspired many, many other memes about the things that RFK did or might have done, including perhaps he and his family sitting down to dinner and eating the body of Jimmy Hoffa, or hijacking that plane as D.B. Cooper, or perhaps training a super sentient species of rat to drag pizzas out of subways. That's my theory. And the other, actually, this interview postdates the actual bear incident, but predates by 6 years RFK's revelation. But we talked to Jordan Ellenberg, who wrote a book called How Not to Be Wrong. He's a Wisconsin mathematics professor. And, you know, it's about political polling and the mistakes, heuristics that sometimes pollsters make, sometimes we make in interpreting the polls. It's always good to know how not to be wrong. So Jordan Ellenberg from 2018 and RFK from this week talking about all those years ago when he decided to store an ursine in America's most prominent shared space. If you look at the forecasters of what's going to happen in the 2018 elections, you'll see generally predictions that Democrats will retake the House. There was quite a kerfuffle when the generic ballot dipped a little bit. A couple weeks ago, generic Democrats were doing much better than generic Republicans. Now, in one survey, they're doing 7 points better. Here's the thing. There are no generic Democrats. There are no generic Republicans. Well, I've met a few Republicans. Some of them are kind of generic. But actual Republicans go up against actual Democrats. So let's take with a grain of salt what they say about the generic ballot. But now let's move to the Senate. And in the Senate, it might be true that there is large anti-Trump animus. It might be true that a blue wave might be hitting us. It's just that the seats in the Senate that are up for vote are so horrible for the Democrats. There are 100 senators, and every 2 years, a third of the Senate, either 33 or 34 seats, go up for vote. This time around, the Democrats are defending all but 8 of the seats. So the Democrats have to defend 25 seats, and the Republicans therefore have a chance to pick up 25 while only having 8 of their own up for vote. Now, I was thinking of this in terms of math. It seems unlucky for the Democrats. In fact, it seems fabulously unlucky. I wanted to put a number on it. So joining me now is Jordan Ellenberg. He is a professor of mathematics at the University of Wisconsin at Madison. His author of How Not to Be Wrong, The Power of Mathematical Thinking. Jordan, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. I want to not be wrong about this. I have some math.
You're in danger. You're in danger of being wrong about this. That's well, why I'm here.
Yeah, first I want to stipulate, and I will stipulate, it's not just math. It's not coin flipping. It's actual seats. And if people win or if people lose, it's because of a number of factors like...
In Virginia, it was coin flipping.
Yeah, it was coin flipping. That's right. It came down to they put a ball in a film can, and then they picked out the film canister with the correct name because, I don't know, film canisters, they have so many of them lying around.
The last film canister in the state, no doubt.
Exactly. By the way, okay, we could even diverge on that. What's a better mathematical way to break a tie, do you think?
Oh, I've got a lot on this. But yeah, if you want it to be 50-50, I think the film canister is as good as any other. I think okay, it's just optics.
Let's talk about just the math involved in the Senate. Now, granted, it's not just math. It's people running for office. But what we've essentially done is, in a Senate that's almost 50-50, it's 51 Republican and 49 Democrats, we've chosen 33 seats at random. We'll asterisk that because it's not random. It goes in order. But we've chosen 33 seats. And therefore, if the seats up for bid reflected the general composition of the body, we'd get something like 17 Republicans running and 16 Democrats running. But it's far from that. How far from that? Seems right. Like very far.
That's
from
what
that.
You would expect if it was a random sample.
Yeah,
state.
Yeah.
That's right.
So should we be looking at this and saying that it is really unusual for the Democrats?
Well, I think there's two ways to look at it. First of all, what is the reason for there to be a lot of Democratic sitting senators in those states? Well, the reason is that 6 years ago, Democrats won a lot of elections. So one aspect of what's going on is that there is a kind of built-in reversion to the mean, if you like, where if you have a lot of seats to defend, it's because you have a lot of seats. And if you have a lot of seats, it's because you did well last time. So, I mean, the way this thing is structured is that the better you do one time, the more challenge you face holding on to those gains the next time.
Okay, that's an excellent point. And there's another point, I think, adjacent to that, which is we're not just randomly picking 33 seats every 2 years. We're going in order so that all the seats are up for bid. And if there's one set of seats where it's 8 Republicans and 25 Democrats, it'll even out. Maybe the next one will be the exact opposite, or generally you're going to have more Republicans defending their seats should the chamber stay roughly even. So it'll all even out at the end of 6 years.
Well, of course, we don't know it'll all even out, but what's definitely true is that, as you say, the seats in the Senate cleave into these three groups, Class 1, Class 2, and Class 3.
Yeah.
And the ones that are up for election in 2018 are the Class 1 seats. So here's the thing. Those groups of Senate seats are actually pretty different in terms of how Democratic-leaning or how Republican-leaning they are. I have to admit, I never knew this until you asked me this question. But another reason that a lot of Democrats are sitting in seats to be defended in 2018 is that the seats that are in Class 1 are pretty Democratic seats. I mean, of those 33, you have 21 states that Obama won in 2012 and 12 states that Mitt Romney won. So that's definitely leaning towards Democrats. So in other words, Democrats have a lot of seats to defend in 2018. They're going to win a lot of those seats, and they're again going to have a lot of seats to those same seats to defend in 2024. I just added six in my head. Congratulations to me. Because a lot of those states are solidly Democratic states, and in the short term, they're going to stay Democratic states. So they have a lot of states to defend, but a lot of them are, in some sense, easy states to defend.
All right. That's true. I take that all in stride. Yet here's the math, and if anyone could take my math and tell me I'm right or wrong. Everything you said is true, but the notion of we have this particular assortment, I just wanted to try to put a number on it. So it's like, stop me if I make any mistakes. We have, and for my purposes, I'm gonna assume a 50-50 Senate, even though it's 51-49. I couldn't do the math with 51-49, but we have 100 balls, 50 are red and 50 are blue. We've just chosen 33 balls. Like I said, a likely outcome would be something like 17 red balls, 16 blue balls. Instead, we get 25 blue balls and 8 red balls. For my calculations, and this is only based on if it were a coin flip, if the Senate really were 50-50, to have 8 blue balls out of those 33 would be a 1 in 618 chance. To have 7 blue balls out of those 23 would be something like a 1 in 2,000 chance on down until I calculated the odds of there being 8 or fewer Democratic seats as a 1 in 500 chance, just if we were mathematically assigning the chance to this Senate election and say, what are the chances that we have such a disparate blue balls or Democratic seats up for bid?
Right. So how unlikely is it that the Democrats would have such a big blue balls problem?
Yeah, I knew.
You said it.
I was thinking of turning it into blue chips and red chips, but.
So here's the thing about that computation, which is, you know, like a lot of mathematical computations we do in politics is correct as a mathematical computation, but sort of hideously irrelevant in terms of the political realities, which are that when we talk about, okay, I flip 30 coins or I pull 30 balls out of an urn, in probability, balls are always kept in an urn. I've never even seen an urn. I don't even really know what one is, but that's where you keep your balls that you pull them out of. When you do a selection like that, you're always making an assumption that's called independence. You're saying that what happens on one coin flip doesn't affect what happens in the next coin flip, which is very true if you're talking about like two coins that you have in your hand. It's very false if you're talking about two states in the same election. So I was thinking back on this, I was thinking back to an infamous article I wrote for Slate in 2006 about why the Democrats were not going to regain control of the House of Representatives. Spoiler, they did regain control of the House of Representatives. And it was exactly because I was asserting too much independence between those seats. I was correctly saying, boy, the Democrats have a lot of seats they've got to win. There's a lot of close seats, but the Democrats had to win like 75 or 80% of them in order to seize control. And I did the same kind of computation you just did. Boy, what's the chance that if they flip that coin 30 times, they're going to get 25 heads? Pretty low.
Right.
Pretty low. But of course, states are not like coins. They are at the mercy of kind of national trends that push you in one direction or the other. And so it can happen, and gosh, it seems like in recent elections it's happened quite a lot, that one party or the other will just have the win behind it. They'll win every close race, not by luck, but because that's just the direction things are going, that races that look close based on polling fundamentals as we understand them are actually not that close because there's an unmeasurable national mood that's pushing in one direction or another.
Yes, yes. This exactly describes a big flaw in many of the models. Not 538's model, Nate would always talk about this, but in many of the models of the last election, where the Princeton model, for instance, says, well, Hillary Clinton has a slight lead in Pennsylvania and a slight lead in Michigan and a slight lead in Wisconsin. And so, yeah, she could lose one or she could lose two, but the odds of her losing all three when she's an 80% chance winds up being whatever it is, like something like a 96% chance that it won't happen. But that's not how to calculate it. When the circumstances of one state flipping present themselves, those circumstances are often there for another state.
Exactly. And I think how to model that is a hell of a lot more subtle than how to model a computation in one state where you have a bunch of polls and basically you're averaging those poll numbers together. It can get a little more fancy than that, but it's no great mystery what you're supposed to do if you have a lot of polls in one state. The question of how those states are related to each other is much more subtle, and that affects how we think about how unlikely is the present difficult-to-defend situation of Democrats that you discussed. In other words, how unlikely was it that the Democrats did so well in 2012? It also affects what you think is likely to happen in 2018. How likely is it that the Democrats or the Republicans are going to kind of run the table on those close races?
Right, that's true. So maybe my calculation would be a little more accurate if we said, all right, our system of democracy was invented yesterday, and we are going to randomly decide which Senate seats, like truly randomly decide which Senate seats come for vote in 2018. And then we got this random assortment out of a 51-49 Senate that it would be 25 Democratic seats and 8 Republican seats. That's maybe closer to my math being applicable.
You're doing what a good applied mathematician always does, which is when the model doesn't match reality, we just say, how would reality have to change in order to conform more closely to my handsome model?
That's a great point.
You've got the spirit.
Yeah.
I mean, by the way, I think the really interesting election to look at is people were so focused on Trump winning the presidential election, the Electoral College, while losing the popular vote in 2016, that actually I think maybe not quite enough attention has been paid to the fact that the Democrats, I think, really missed a chance with those Class 3 seats. You know, just as I said, the Democrats had a very good election in 2012, which means that they're going to have a lot of seats to defend now.
Yes.
In 2016, you're looking at people who were elected in 2010, a huge Republican wave election. And that is a situation which I think going in, you would say the Republicans had an unusually large and unexpectedly large number of close seats to defend. Because those Class 3 seats, the ones that were up in 2016, that is not such a predominantly Republican collection of states. But right now it is represented by a predominantly Republican collection of senators. So, you know, I hate to say it for Democrats, but the real opportunity for them just passed in 2016 and comes again in 2022.
Right. That's a great point. Like Ron Johnson in Wisconsin, who just as those Wisconsin polls got the presidential election wrong, they thought that Russ Feingold would take back his seat. But no, it was Ron Johnson. And in fact, other Republicans who were either in a toss up or maybe slightly leaning Republican state, like Burr in North Carolina and Portland,
Toomey in Pennsylvania.
Right, Toomey, Portland. All those Republicans won. That's an excellent point. And so the next time around, we might be saying, oh, look at all these Class 3 seats, so overwhelmingly Republican. There's a reason for that.
Call me back in 4 years and we'll do this again, because I think that is the right group of seats with which to ask this question.
By the way, do you think, I don't know how you would put a number on it, you know, 538 was saying that that Trump's chance of winning was like, you know, in the 30s. Hillary's chance, I forgot the exact thing, was like 65. Do you think he was right? Like, he might have been right. He might have had that perfect.
So this is a great question, another deep philosophical question. This is how you assess it. You can't assess that about one event. You can't, because what happened, happened. You don't get to run it 1,000 times and see if it happened 350 out of those 1,000 times. You know, one way, there's two ways of looking at what we mean when we talk about a probability. We could mean, like with coins, oh, if I do this 1,000 times, how many times is it going to come heads? Okay, with elections, that's not really what we're doing, right? Because there is no single election we're going to run 1,000 times. Usually, we're not even going to run it twice.
Yeah.
So if it's not measuring that, what is it measuring? Well, most people would say it's measuring your degree of belief. Right, some measure of like what you know about the situation. And of course, what you know is going to change between January and October. So it would be very weird if those odds didn't change. It's like when you complain that a politician's position on something changed. Well, if new things happen, why shouldn't it change? It would actually be very weird if it didn't change over time under new conditions.
Yes. When given new information, I change my mind. What do you do? It's a famous quote.
Right. It's somebody's pithy quote, but I forgot who.
Yeah. All right. Jordan Ellenberg is the author of How Not to Be Wrong, The Power of Mathematical Thinking. He's a professor of math at University of Wisconsin-Madison. He keeps his powder dry, his light under a bushel, and his balls in an urn. Thank you, Jordan.
Thanks, Mike.
And now the spiel. The RFK Jr. for President campaign probably won't amount to much, but the upcoming RFK Jr. book, Brainworms and Black Bears, it's about to be a bestseller. So to catch you up, 10 years ago in Central Park, the body of a black bear was found. Now, if you're not from New York, you may be thinking, oh, that happens all the time. Not so, as NBC reporter Andrew Schiff documented the day of the incident via this interview with a surprised park goer.
How unusual is that?
Very unusual. I've never seen a bear. I mean, I've lived in New York City all my life, and I've gone to Central Park with different dogs.
Never seen a bear, even despite walking all those dogs. And indeed, no bears were to be seen again or heard from for quite some time, until a story emerged as reported by the New Yorker's Claire Malone. This case of ursicide has emerged from hibernation in the cold case file, admitting to the at least staging the accident part of this bear murder is, in fact, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. He is now here heard in the traditional form of confession, a Twitter video, as he regales the tale to Roseanne Barr. I realize this may all be strange. It might be hard to understand, disorienting. So I'm going to try to help you out by using a familiar bear-themed narrative structure. We start with RFK describing his thought process as he encounters a dead bear cub on the road in upstate New York.
So I pulled over and I picked up the bear and put him in the back of my van because I was going to skin the bear, and it was very good condition, and I was going to put the meat in my refrigerator. And you can do that in New York City if you've got a bear
tag. A while back, I found a bear dead on the road. Life isn't fair. A while back I found a bear dead on the road. Life isn't fair.
We stayed late, and instead of going back to my home in Westchester, I had to go right to the city because there was a dinner at Peter Luger's Steakhouse. And at the end of the dinner, it went late, and I realized I couldn't go home. I had to go to the airport, and the bear was in my car, and I didn't want to leave the bear.
I put the bear inside my van. It sounds real dumb, but I had a plan. I put the bear inside my van. It sounds real dumb, but I had a plan.
I had an old bike in my car that somebody asked me to get rid of. I said, let's go put the bear in Central Park and we'll make it look like he got hit by a bike.
I went to dine, ran out of time. I said, well then, I'll stage a crime. I went to dine, ran
ran out of time. I said, well, then I'll stage a crime.
Florence Slatkin says she was walking her dog this morning when she saw something furry underneath the bushes. Police say the 3-foot-long black bear cub had stab and slash wounds and appears to have been dumped there. Adding to the mystery, Slatkin says the baby bear was lying on top of this bicycle, which...
I dumped the bear under a bike. Oh, you might be saying, this guy's a psycho. I dumped the bear under a bike. Oh, you may be saying this guy's a psycho.
But the next day, it was on every television station. It was the front page of every paper. And I turned on the TV and there was like a mile of yellow tape and there were 20 cop cars. There were helicopters flying over it. And I was like, oh my God, what did I do?
I got found out, okay by me. I like attention and falconry. I got found out, okay by me. I like attention and falconry.
The New Yorker somehow found out about it, and they just, they're going to do a big article on me, and that's one of the articles. So they asked me, the fact checker said, you know, it's going to be a bad story.
Claire Malone's story hit today. It's all true. There's also a picture of RFK posing with his finger in the bear mouth, pretending to be bitten. It's not a bad story. It's a great story. Don't you love this story? Roseanne Barr was enraptured. The internet's blowing up. If good story means it tells you all you need to know about RFK, I mean, was the jury ever really out anyway? I think about this sometimes, not from the perspective of RFK, Claire Malone, or Boo Boo. Think about, what about the lady who hit the bear? 10 years ago, she was probably telling a friend, I don't know, maybe it was Johnny Galecki, probably not, just a friend up there in Goshen, New York, about this really weird thing that happened. Went something like this. Oh my God, you won't believe what happened. I saw a bear on the road. Oh, wow. Well, you know, that happened to me too the other day. You know, up here, there's a lot of bears. No, wait, hold on. I hit the bear. Oh no. And I killed the bear. Oh, wow. And then a guy came along, and said, I'll take the bear from you and put it in my refrigerator. No way. That is, I guess, some crazy good luck taking a bear off your hands. How could that ever happen? So this guy, he says, you know, I'm into falconry. Oh, my God. Okay. Let's recap. This is crazy luck. A guy who's into a medieval sport comes upon a bear hitting a road, and he says, I'm one of the 1,000 people who might have this plan, but I have a plan to eat the bear like they did in the Middle Ages. What are the chances? Oh, whatever those chances are, these are even lower, because the guy was Robert F. Kennedy Jr. What? I know. He was the guy? Yes. The son of slain New York senator and brightest hope for progressive governance the country has known in the last 75 years, Robert F. Kennedy. His son is into refrigerating the carcasses of roadkill bears and also falconry. And falconry. How did you know about the falconry? Actually, couldn't stop talking about the falconry. This is literally the strangest story I have ever heard. Oh, it gets weirder. 2 days later, there were headlines everywhere. Maybe you saw the headlines. Bear body found in Central Park. Oh, wait a minute. You don't think it's your bear? Oh, I know it's my bear. They have pictures. It's the same bear. It's your bear? No, it's Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s bear. Oh, my God. Listen, this is the absolute craziest thing I have ever heard. It gets crazier. Stop. I went to a fortune teller. No, really, stop. And she said, in 10 years, this is going to be an issue in the race for president of the United States because Robert F. Kennedy Jr. will be a candidate for president of the United States. Okay, now I know you're lying, but he still won't be good enough to beat the candidate who is running, who has been president of the United States,
I think you're lying. And that man is Donald Trump. Okay, you're insulting me. You know, we used to be friends before this crazy fortune teller Donald Trump bear RFK thing. You need help. You've wasted my time. I see you as a clearly deranged person. I'm ending our relationship. I am never going to talk to you again. And that person, well, you may not know her. What she did was she left the room that day and she never talked to her bear slaughtering friend again. But when she started seeing that all those predictions turned out to be true, she began posting on the internet. You may not know her by her Christian name, Beatrice Quigley. You may only know her by her screen name, Q. And this has been perhaps the greatest story ever to happen in the history of The Gist. That's it for the show. Corey Wara produces The Gist. Joel Patterson's the senior producer. And Leo Baum bounds it up as the intern. Intern Unbound. Prometheus Unbound. Leo is his name, not Prometheus. We will talk to you on Monday.